Ladies and gentlemen, Happiness in Darkness proudly presents our 40th feature presentation, Avengers Infinity War. The Avengers and their allies have continued to protect the world from threats too large for any one hero to handle. A new danger now emerges from the cosmic shadows, Thanos. A despot of intergalactic infamy, his goal is to collect all 6 Infinity Stones, artifacts of unimaginable power, and use them to inflict his twisted will on all of reality. Everything the Avengers have fought for has led up to this moment. The fate of Earth and existence has never been more uncertain. The Infinity War has begun. Ciao, my people, and welcome to our 40th episode special of Happiness in Darkness, the superhero movie podcast, where we cover superhero movies from Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, Image, and more. If it came from a comic and had theatrical release, you know we'll discuss it. Naturally, there will be spoilers, folks, so you have been warned. I'm one of your co-hosts, DJ Nick, and today we'll be discussing Infinity War. And with me today to discuss what may possibly be the biggest heist movie in history are our 4 podcasting Avengers. Let's count them down. First off, we have the mighty, mighty Charles Skaggs. Hey, Charles, how are you doing?
I'm doing fabulous. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful, thanks, Charles, and super happy to be having you with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm always proud to assemble when needed. Especially for your podcast, because you're always so kind to come on our podcast, and I have to return the favor.
Oh, well, we greatly appreciate, you know, your hospitality, and we're super happy to have you with us. And of course, you know, following Mr. Charles Skaggs, we have the wonderful John Takis. How are you doing, John?
Doing great, Nick.
Well, we're very, very happy to have you with us today, John. And of course, we also have Kelly Pippin. How are you doing, Kelly?
I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
I can't complain, Kelly. It's definitely amazing, and I can't believe we've already reached 40 episodes on this podcast, and you've definitely been a big part of that indeed. And last but definitely not least, the one and only Leslie Cause Mather. How are you doing, Leslie?
Hey, Nick. I'm doing good, thanks.
Well, we're very, very happy to have you all here with us today, guys. So today we are reviewing, of course, Infinity War from 2018, directed by Anthony and John Russo, who we have also met on Civil War and will soon be meeting again on The Winter Soldier. It was written by MCU veterans Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely. The original score was by the one and only Alan Silvestri. And on estimate, guys, this movie cost around $408 million to make, and it made over $2 billion at the box office. So to say it was a success is definitely an understatement. So guys, first off, before we actually get down into some of our topics and such, I wanted to just go around the table here a little bit and get your first impressions, as it were, or your first memories of when you got to see this film and what your first impressions were. So let's start with you, Charles. What were your thoughts when you went into Infinity War?
Well, obviously I was really looking forward to this because of, you know, we had about 8 years of buildup for this movie throughout the various Marvel Cinematic Universe films. Little teases here and there, you know, little cameos by Thanos in little post-credit scenes throughout the Avengers movies and whatnot. And so everything was culminating to this movie. And thankfully, this movie does not disappoint. I was excited when it arrived in theaters. Fortunately, I saw it opening night. I had to see this movie opening night, and because, you know, spoilers were going to be all over the internet, and I definitely did not want this film spoiled for me. And I'm just pleased that it lived up to the hype, because a lot of movies don't do that. And it's absolutely one of my favorites. It's in my personal top 10.
Well, I definitely cannot blame you for that. And what about you, John? You know, you being the Iron Man guy and having seen all the Iron Man films and stuff, what were your thoughts about the first time you got to see Infinity War?
Well, just like Charles, I tried to stay away from the internet. There was a chance I was able to get to see it opening day. So yeah, I was all in for that. But the the previews that we had gotten before that, a lot of the reviewers had said, okay, well, you know what, in the first 5 minutes, there's a death, and that's all they gave us for the first part of their review. It's like, okay, so who's going to die? And of course, yeah, we see what happens, but I stayed away from. I normally don't care about spoilers, but this one I didn't want anything spoiling me. And I got a chance to see it opening day, and it did not disappoint. This is something I've been waiting for a long time to see, and I can't even tell you how many times I've seen it or watched it since then. I mean, with technology as it is right now, I can just throw a movie out on my phone while I'm doing something. I've seen it countless times since then. But yeah, it's like Charles said, also it's one of my favorites.
Well, it definitely sounds like you definitely enjoyed yourself. And Kelly, you know, you and I actually discussed the movie prior to this, should we say, Thor Ragnarok. And, you know, going then into Infinity War and knowing how much of a big Marvel guy you are, what would you say were your first impressions on this film?
Well, I mean, okay, so unlike everybody else, I had to go on media blackout for like a week and a half, almost 2 weeks before I actually got to go see the movie. So I just answered my phone and didn't pay attention to the internet for about a week and a half or 2 weeks. And then I went to go see it, and it did not disappoint in any way, shape, or form. I mean, the buildup, that the biggest concern for me was, like, we've been going at this for years and we've had all these teasers, and then here it is. And are we going to see the big bad Thanos on screen? And, you know, how's this going to turn out? And it did not in any way, shape, or form disappoint. It was a fantastic movie. And there's a lot of, there's just a lot to it. I mean, they crammed a lot into the time that they had, and it's pretty amazing to watch.
It was certainly a big effort indeed. And you, Leslie, you know, being in, of course, in California, and I believe actually, you know, in Los Angeles, right by Los Angeles, I'm sure there must have been quite a hype when this film came out. Did you also get to see it at the theater on opening day?
Opening weekend. And like John said, I tend to not care so much about spoilers, but this was different. And yeah, I was even opening day the next day, people were talking about it and texting, and I just, you know, was trying as best I could to stay away from it. And I'm so invested in this whole franchise that, you know, I was counting the days to find out what was going to happen next. And again, I didn't think it disappointed either.
Oh, well, it seems like we all have pretty much showed our hands when it comes to this film, indeed, as I am pretty much in the same mind frame as all of you. I mean, I absolutely love this movie, so I think it's going to be getting a lot of love, folks. This is going to be one of those reviews where, you know, we're definitely enjoyed it. So let's get down to our topics here when it comes to film, as there is quite a bit to unpack. So our first topic here is, we had a Hulk and a Loki. So when it comes actually to, you know, of course, because in this film, we get the appearance of the Hulk for a very brief period just at the beginning, and then he just disappears, and we, of course, get Bruce Banner for the rest of the film, and as John was mentioning, the death of Loki right at the beginning of the film, which was just mind-blowing. So let's start with you, Charles. What did you think of the fact that we had literally no Hulk in this film, and how did you take the death of Loki?
I thought it was very interesting creative choice to bench the Hulk, as it were, for this film. You know, obviously the Hulk is this huge physical threat, and which is why it's so stunning, and it really sets the tone for the rest of the film to essentially have the Hulk getting his green ass kicked hard by Thanos and in this movie, and, you know, in the beginning, and because you figure, well, okay, the Hulk is the strongest there is, and turns out, well, no, he's not, not with Thanos around. And so I know a lot of fans that were Hulk fans were like, oh yeah, you know, can't wait to see Hulk face off with Thanos. And then to have that completely flipped on its head, to have Thanos just mop the floor with the Hulk, and it really makes you take Thanos seriously as a threat, because you figure, well, if he can do that to the Hulk, what's it going to do with everybody else? And so it sets the tone perfectly. And then Loki obviously tries his attempt to take out Thanos early, but by this point, Thanos is still too powerful for him. Thanos totally sees it coming, and it almost seems like you're a little puzzled why Loki even attempted this, because it was just such a futile gesture on his part, and it caused his death. But knowing what we know now, that the Loki TV series is going to be coming to Disney Plus, we have to wonder, well, was this just another trick from the God of Tricksters? And was he in fact killed by Thanos?
Well, yes, no, definitely. I mean, some great points there for sure. And what about you, John? I mean, what do you think of this, shall we say, almost Hulkless film and the death of Loki?
Well, the death of Loki, it resonated in the theater about the same amount as the last, say, 7 or 8 minutes of the film before the credits. The entire theater was silent. And as soon as you hear Thanos snap his neck just by just crushing it, and Thor just, I mean, he can't cry out because he's got, he's all like almost muzzled. I mean, the whole day, there's just like a gasp. And that was the only sound we heard in the theater. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, this could be the end of him. I mean, I'm now that we know that there's going to be a Loki series, obviously something's going to happen. But at that point in time, we were just like, oh, here's the death that they were talking about. And, with the fact that I was kind of curious why we didn't see the Hulk until he appeared. I mean, you've got Thanos walking around over all these dead Asgardians with his with the children of Thanos behind him. Where was the Hulk before then, though? That was my only kind of qualm about that. Obviously he does turn up. He gets thrown around like a rag doll. But the fact that we don't see him in the movie as much after that, it's just more or less more Banner than Hulk. I did kind of like that because we got a chance to see how Bruce acts with he's in the Hulkbuster. How cool is that to have the Hulkless Hulk in the Hulkbuster armor? But the whole thing, then you get the almost like the erectile dysfunction jokes that Tony's giving him. You know, like he's like, you got to show up. You have to, like, come on, we're what's going on with this? And it lended to the movie to the point where I think if we did have the Hulk in it, it would be more of the more of like kind of the way the Infinity Gauntlet comic was. I mean, he was just kind of like a back character.
Oh, well, very much so, very much so. And Kelly, you know, as I mentioned, you and I actually talked Thor Ragnarok, where we got a lot of the Hulk in that film. Now, not having a Hulk in this case, and also, of course, you know, got to see Loki in Thor Ragnarok as well. What were your thoughts on the choices here of not going with the Hulk and of course, Loki dying so early?
Well, I think Loki's the ultimate trickster. So I think Loki's death was Loki's way of, I'll live to fight another day. I wasn't as taken aback by it, I think, as everybody was when they first saw the movie, because how many times has Loki died? And I mean, let's be honest. I just kind of took that with a grain of salt, and I was like, okay, he's, you know, Thanos's ego, especially after beating up the Hulk and all this stuff, his ego and pride were bigger than he was. And I think that kind of got in his way, and quite possibly Loki pulled the ultimate trick there on Thanos and skirted out of there and, you know, did his thing as usual. I think that the choice to bench the Hulk in this movie by Marvel was a big one, because it gave, I think if the Hulk would have been involved completely and utterly in this battle, things would have went a little different. And I feel like they benched him because ultimately, the Hulk is a threat to Thanos physically. Now, mentally, no. But physically, yes. I mean, the Hulk, you know, the angrier he gets, the stronger he gets. And I think had the fight between him and Thanos lasted very long at all, it would have been a problem, and I think Thanos knew that. So I think Thanos made quick work of it. I think Marvel wanted to bring Thanos to the forefront as this large threat, and I think by beating the Hulk, he did that right off the bat, just like Charles said. And I think, you know, benching the Hulk in this movie and also not bringing in Captain Marvel in this movie, there are reasons that they didn't want to bring overpowered heroes into this, because Thanos had to fulfill all the things that they had brought to the forefront here. Thanos had to win this one. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with that. I think that's how they stepped into this and rolled it out for us. And it worked. I mean, we had audience standing on the edge of their seats waiting for the next, you know, next shoe to drop. So it was a fantastic way to lead into this. And I think they made a smart choice benching the Hulk. I love the Hulk. I wish he'd have showed up at the end, but you know, you can't have your cake and eat it too sometimes. So, you know.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. Yeah, very, very well said. And Leslie, you know, when it comes to you, I mean, were you happy that, I guess, we kind of had Mark Ruffalo more of the chance to shine in this film? And I know that you're quite the fan of Loki and of Tom Hiddleston. So what do you think of these choices that were made for this film?
Yeah, it's so interesting. You know me so well. I was going to say that this movie is a massive undertaking. You know, you've got all these origin stories and this culmination of bringing all these characters together into one, you know, 2-hour, 40-minute, whatever it was, film. And you've got to, I guess, drown some puppies, so to speak, you know, leave some things on the cutting room floor. And I'm sure they sat around trying to figure out, you know, what was worth leaving and what was worth getting rid of for the sake of time. I think that you know, the Hulk and Banner, that's an interesting thing to think about in terms of acting. You know, the actor Mark Ruffalo can do a whole lot more as Banner than he can as the Hulk. And I couldn't help but wonder, you know, if they wanted to give him a little more, because pretty much everybody in this film was limited in the amount of airtime they got, screen time they got. So I loved the play on, you know, the Hulk not wanting to come out. I loved the twist from at the beginning of the whole unfolding of his character in this franchise, that, you know, Banner does not want him to come out. And now we've come full circle to, you know, slapping his face to try to get him to come out, and he doesn't want to. So that was great. And the Loki thing for me, I remember seeing this film and then going to lunch afterwards and just sitting there. the discussion went on and on about whether or not Loki really was dead. And there was like a weird sense of grieving that was going on at the table. You know, if he is dead, what does that mean? If he's not, how could that be? You know, and I think when you have a bad guy, an antagonist that people love, that's endearing, I think you've got a winning situation. And that is certainly what Loki is. He's just become a hero in his own way.
Oh, yes, he very much has. And I think so many people absolutely love Loki. I mean, he kind of is almost seen as the poster child for villainy in the MCU. When it came to me personally, I mean, you know, to Bruce Banner, the absence of the Hulk in this film, I thought, you know, it was kind of fun how most they played it, because my first thought was maybe there was almost a performance anxiety on his part as he'd had his butt handed to him by Thanos in his first encounter. And so he was almost cowering. But of course, we know that that is not the Hulk's way, as we had also seen this in Ragnarok. And we know how much Hulk enjoys a challenge and loves to fight anything and everything. And it was almost much more of an inner struggle between Bruce and Hulk, and two different characters that I guess share the same host, and it's actually the only character that has this, shall we say, trait or particular thing. And we know that Hulk's great dislike of Bruce continues to grow throughout the course of these movies. And it could almost be seen, I think, as an act of defiance on Hulk's part, in almost not wanting to be Bruce's puppet and surface at his beck and call. This is actually also, you see this in quite a few comics as well. I personally would have liked to have seen the Hulk in this movie, even more so after his character had been more developed by Taika Waititi in Thor Ragnarok. So it was a missed opportunity, I think, though, as I was mentioning, it did give Mark Ruffalo more to do And also, as John was mentioning, it was great to see him in the Hulkbuster, which was a nice callback to the Age of Ultron fight between Hulk and Iron Man. So I thought that was kind of cool. And it did leave for an interesting thread to pick up when it came to Endgame. And when it came to the death of Loki, well, it did shock me at the time. Not to mention, I mean, as you folks probably felt, it was pretty brutal. And part of me thought, this can't be the end of Loki, as you'd spent so much time establishing him as one of the leading villains, and I doubted they would do away with him that quickly. Though it was a nice recognition, I think, of the history between Loki and Thanos. As you know, in the Battle of New York in the first Avengers film, there was that alliance between Loki and the Chitauri, and of course, Thanos in the background. So it was almost like Thanos punishing him, saying, you know, you were supposed to take over the Earth and stuff and you failed, so I'm going to kill you. Regardless, of course, of Loki also trying to kill Thanos. So it was a nice little tying up of the ribbon there, as it were. So I really liked it. And I thought it was very much a can't believe they did that moment. But I guess we all in our hearts of hearts knew that that was not the end of Loki. So from this topic, let's move on to our next one, which is happily entitled We're Off to Save the Wizard, where we look at Doctor Strange, Iron Man, and Spider-Man, a rather interesting trio to see finally together. So when it comes to you, John, what did you think of the Wizard, the Iron Man, and Spider-Man together?
Oh, I thought it was such a fun fight to watch. And I think if I'm not mistaken, I think this is the first time we actually get to see Peter's Spidey sense in the MCU when the hair is raised up on his arm. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that before in the previous movies. But I mean, just the camaraderie that you get between Tony and Peter. I mean, Peter's like Tony's illegitimate son. He's taking him on as Doctor Strange, kind of like, well, is this your ward? He's doing everything that he can to show Tony that he's up for the challenge. He can help out wherever needed, and he does. There's a few moments where they take off and he's holding on by his web, and you hear him like yelling as he's getting flown around. And but he holds his own, and obviously Tony has like the new armor, which as soon as he suits up with the nanotechnology, Bruce is like, he's like, oh, when'd you get that? And he likes to, being the geek that he is, he likes to talk about it, what he's made. So he's over here talking about it. All of a sudden, he gets plowed from the big guy with the axe. I was just like, oh, geez. But it was a really fun battle to watch.
And did you like the introduction of Doctor Strange and the relationship between Doctor Strange and Iron Man?
I did. It was just one of those things where it's like you've got two very intellectual characters, and they're just kind of going at it with each other. But then it's like, oh, wait a second, there's a bigger threat outside. We better put this down and take care of it. And the whole the Ben and Jerry's thing was pretty funny with the Stark raving hazelnuts, I like the fact that it became more of a team the more they fought together, because they knew that there's no way that they could do this on their own. But yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Oh, no, well, definitely. And Kelly, you know, you and I actually reviewed the Doctor Strange on this podcast, you know, before he became a full part of the MCU, and we got to see him interact with other characters. And of course, also Thor Ragnarok, once again, we see him interact with Thor. What did you think of seeing, you know, Doctor Strange, Iron Man, and Spider-Man together at the same time?
Well, I think what Marvel did there was they put the three intellectuals together, because they understood each other, their techniques, their fighting styles, things like that. Doctor Strange knows that Tony Stark is no idiot, and he also understands that of all the Avengers, a lot of times Tony's going to understand the direction he's going more so than the rest of them. I mean, Cap's not a dummy, and neither is, you know, the Black Panther, or you can just go down the list. None of them are dummies, but I think on an intellectual level, you know, you've got Bruce, you've got Tony, you've got Doctor Strange, and you've got Peter. And Peter's always been, you know, even in the comics, he's been an intellectual powerhouse when it comes to certain things. And I think Tony recognizes that in him and wants to foster it. I think that's why their relationship is so tight, is the fact that Tony respects Peter's intelligence and his willingness to use that for, you know, all the things of good. And seeing those three together and the dynamic that they create, you know, Doctor Strange isn't going to let anything happen to his world, period. And Tony's of the same mind, especially after, you know, the events of the Avengers. And then you've got Peter that wants to be a part of this and wants to be able to help, you know, save the world and not just New York City. So I think they play off each other wonderfully. I think that, you know, Doctor Strange, you know, in this movie, you know, tells Tony, you know, hey, I've seen all these possibilities and there's only one where we win. And, you know, that comes to pass later on. But just it was exciting to watch and exciting to see these three, you know, work together as a team and watch the battles that they, you know, they went through, you know, during this movie. And it's just, yeah, it was just absolutely probably, you know, one of the most amazing things in the movie to watch. Magic, technology and brain power all in one shot. So.
Oh, yes, indeed, because here we have, of course, magic on one side and technology on the other. And Leslie, what did you think of, you know, seeing these three come together, you know, having enjoyed them in their solo movies?
Yeah, I think I agree with everything that's been said. And to add, I guess it was looking at it sort of like a character triangle. You know, you've got these two not only intellectuals, but egomaniacs, you know, in Bruce and Strange. And they were kind of holding their own against each other in a lot of ways, or at least Tony maybe met his match. Because when you have Tony paired up against Bruce, you know, Bruce is always going to concede because he doesn't like confrontation. But these two were going head to head. And I think Tony respects that. And I think he likes a good fight and he's willing to admit, you know, when someone makes a good point. And so it's very intellectual banter. And then on, you know, the other side of the triangle, you have Tony and the kid. And I've always loved from the beginning to the end, their relationship because, you know, I think Tom Holland is an actor we're going to watch for a long time to come. And I love his portrayal of Peter Parker. I find him just very believable and his emotions are always just right there. And I love how he's very vulnerable with Mr. Stark. And yet Tony kind of has his way with him that doesn't seem so friendly at first, but you see that that's just his way. And it's a really cool relationship they have. So, after kind of thinking through it, yeah, then it made perfect sense to me, the intellectual thing going on, and loved the whole banter and loved the battle, and I really loved the Ben and Jerry's thing.
And what about you, Charles? What do you think of this trio of ours?
I really love these characters. I think what really works about them is that they're such strong personalities. Leslie brought up that when you have Tony Stark and Dr. Stephen Strange in the same room, you essentially have these two huge, colossal egos butting heads, and essentially trying to out alpha each other. To show their dominance, because, you know, Tony Stark, obviously he feels he's the smartest man in the room. But then so does, you know, Dr. Strange in his own way. And so, to see it was great to see these two characters have that kind of conflict, but also realize, you know, that over the events that they come to respect each other and, rely on each other because, again, they are two of the smartest people in the room. And then you get the introduction of Doctor Strange meeting Spider-Man. So there's that great little exchange between Peter where he introduces himself and he says, "Hi, I'm Peter." And then, you know, Doctor Strange says, "Well, I'm Doctor Strange." And, you know, and then Peter, who doesn't realize that, well, that's also his superhero name, or, you know, that it's real name, assumes it's a superhero name. And so he's like, "Oh, you know, we're using the kid names now." I'm Spider-Man. Your made up names, yes, thank you. And so it's a great moment. And I think it kind of endears Peter a little bit to Doctor Strange as a result. The only thing I don't really like about Peter with Tony is that when Tony's on screen, Peter kind of gets relegated to this kid sidekick role. Mm-hmm. And one of my big problems with how the Marvel Cinematic Universe depiction of Spider-Man goes, it just, you know, that he's so young and compared to Tony Stark, he always feels inferior. Peter does. And it doesn't really give him as often to shine unless it's with Tony's help. So
yeah, he's not as seasoned as he was in the comics.
Exactly. Or even in the Tobey Maguire movies.
Right.
So I feel kind of let down by that because I'm a big Spider-Man fan. And I'd like to see Peter kind of step into the forefront. And I know that's kind of like the theme of Spider-Man Far From Home, trying to fill Tony's shoes. But here, Peter relies so much on Tony. And even, with getting the new Iron Spider suit that he gets and just to protect him from space. And so obviously, when the end of the film comes around, that feeling, that mentor versus protege relationship that they have becomes all the more meaningful when Peter vanishes. And obviously we'll talk about that when we get around to it.
Oh, yes, indeed, we certainly will. And, I actually, as Kelly also knows from our discussions about Doctor Strange, I absolutely loved the MCU's Doctor Strange. And plus, I'm a huge fan of Benedict Cumberbatch, so that definitely helps. And I could not wait to see him interact with the rest of the characters in the universe, even more so after the brief exchange that we'd had between Thor, Loki, and Doctor Strange in Thor Ragnarok. And especially, I so wanted this. I so wanted Strange and Tony to meet. And when they do, I think it's everything you expect it would be. As, of course, as you guys were actually mentioning, here you have somebody who completely puts his faith in science and very much seems to almost snub or not acknowledge magic at first. While on the other hand, you have this ex-surgeon who is now completely invested in magic and the mystical. And I think it's safe to say, as you, the rest of you have also said, is these are the two biggest egos in the MCU, for sure. Naturally, of course, when you do have two very strong-headed and self-important characters like these two meeting, you know that sparks will fly. Though, of course, there was also, I believe Kelly pointed out, as time rolls on, there is somewhat of a mutual respect which kind of grows between the two. And also, we know that when it comes to Iron Man and Spider-Man, that since Civil War, Tony was a man who was trying to find some semblance of normalcy in his life and wanted to start a life with Pepper and everything that entails. And you can also tell the nightmares that had been haunting him since Age of Ultron are very much made real by these latest events. And probably in his own mind, he might be feeling it will be down to him at the end of the day. Naturally, the relationship with Peter is incredibly parental. And I can see Charles's point of maybe some of this is a bit excessively parental as, they made Spider-Man so young. And of course, as Tom Holland is young in himself. And as we had both seen in Civil War and Homecoming, and you can tell that Tony very much wants to shield Peter from harm and has very much taken full responsibility for him. It's a beautiful relationship and it does get a touching payoff, as you were alluding to, Charles. And I think Peter is incredibly excited about just being where he is because you can tell he feels somewhat out of his depth, like we kind of saw also a little bit in Civil War. But this is even on a bigger and grander scale, and he's almost trying to get to grips with what being an Avenger is all about. But at the same time, you have to love the happy-go-lucky nature, the puns and the jokes, even when he's battling Thanos, which is very true to the character in the comics, as for anybody who's read a Spider-Man comic will know, whatever bad guy he's beating up, he will always make puns. And it's very much the essence of Spider-Man. So I did like it, and I also think it does also bring levity to somewhat his fear and anxiety, which we do get a little bit in this Spider-Man and also in this film. So moving on to our next topic here, folks, we have WandaVision, where we have, of course, the relationship between Wanda and the Vision, with Elizabeth Olsen and Paul Bettany. Now, when it comes to this relationship and these two characters and what they get to do in this film, Kelly, what did you think of, you know, seeing the Scarlet Witch and Vision as a full-blown couple, and did you like what they got to do in this film?
Well, I felt like, this relationship, obviously, you know, Marvel's kind of cultivated this over time. And, you know, I think the Scarlet Witch, I think Vision's probably one of the few people that understand her, that understand what she's capable of. And I think that draws them together as a couple. I'm excited to see, you know, all the new stuff that's going to come from that and the things that are going to happen there. In this movie in particular, I think this is where, you know, you really get to see that part of their relationship. And to me, it's just, you know, it's kind of a, it's a, you know, usually people were, you know, after Wanda or, you know, not the Vision so much. And now all of a sudden, you know, the Vision's being hunted down. She doesn't know what to do. And you get the arrival of Cap and, you know, the Scarlet Witch or, and Black Widow and all that. And, you get to see that little scrap, and you actually get to see how much they care about each other, because each one of them is trying to push the other one off and say, you know, run, go, you know, don't, you know, I can handle this, whatever. And it's just, it's one of those things, and it makes for a touching scene, because all this time, you know, you're kind of building up to all this stuff, and you finally get to see a lot of that's the thing about this movie. You get to see a lot of the relationships come to fruition here in this movie. You get to see how each one of the Avengers functions with each other and how they care about each other. Not only, you know, like Wanda and the Vision, but, you know, every relationship. I mean, we just talked about Tony and Peter and, you know, that relationship. And, you know, you also get to see, you know, the relationship between, you know, Cap and Tony again, and just different things. And it's an amazing ride that they give you, you know, thinking about the Vision and Wanda being a couple. I mean, the Vision was not even, you know, even human. And I think Marvel pushes the envelope a little bit with some of this stuff. But Marvel has always done that. I mean, you've always seen relationships between couples that, you know, in the past you would have never seen, you know, like Cloak and Dagger and things like that. Marvel's always been pushing that envelope, and kudos to them for doing so. I think that has helped a lot of us comic book geeks become a little more educated in life than some other folks. But yeah, I think it's a great show this time. And I think, you know, seeing that relationship, and then it's coming to the small screen pretty soon. So, you know, kind of excited to see that whole scenario unfold.
Oh, I'm definitely looking forward to WandaVision myself, Kelly. And when it comes to you, Leslie, you not being familiar with the comics and having seen, you know, kind of little snippets of the Scarlet Witch Vision relationship kind of grow, did you buy this relationship, and what did you think of it?
Well, see, and you took the words out of my mouth again. I feel like the discussion here is above my pay grade, because I don't have that. And I thought it was weird. I actually loved, just from a if I didn't know how he was created and it was just a relationship, the acting and the scene and the, you know, the way it unfolded was beautiful, and I really believed it. But it was hard for me to figure out how that relationship worked, honestly. And so I'd love to learn more about it, and I'll make that my plan. Yeah, I agree that I really love the use of just the teaming up of relationships, because I do think it does help not only move the stories along individually, but it makes for higher stakes when it comes to tragedy or it comes to choices that they have to make. And they do that really well, and they always have. And this was another form of that. I have always kind of wondered, maybe someone can tell me where her accent went, because it seemed strange to me that it was just gone, you know, but I won't hold it against her. I just find that so, I don't know. I'd love to know the answer. So
I guess Sokovian accents just go away pretty quickly.
Maybe they do.
It was magic.
I guess so.
She's a Scarlet Witch. She uses magic.
Those are almost among the powers of Scarlet Witch. She can magic her accent away.
That's what it is. See, I told you it was about my favorite.
Yeah, and Charles, since you came up with that idea of, you know, magicking one's accent away, what did you think of WandaVision? Should we say the relationship that we got to see? I mean, because here we get to see him as almost a full blown couple come almost out of the blue. Did you buy it? And what did you think of what we got to see of Scarlet Witch and the Vision?
Oh yeah, I was very happy with this because I'm a longtime Avengers fan. So Vision and Scarlet Witch is one of the Marvel Comics' great romances throughout their entire history, I think. Because it's such an offbeat romance. You know, you have this android falling in love with a mutant, you know, spellcaster, and just, you know, this is a couple that really on paper shouldn't work, but against everything, there's this great love there, and so. Seeing that realized in the Marvel Cinematic Universe was, you know, a great thing. You know, Elizabeth Olsen and Paul Bettany have really great chemistry with one another, I think. Here in this film, even though I was a little thrown by all of a sudden the Vision looks human, it looks a lot like Paul Bettany, and no real explanation about why that is. You know, I kind of hand waved it a little bit and just figured, well, okay, they want to give Paul Bettany some scenes without having to wear all that Vision makeup. So, they kind of threw him a bone there a little bit, in those Edinburgh scenes. But it also gave, you know, it allowed taking away that makeup allowed more of the Vision's, for lack of a better term here, humanity to come through. And to show how much the Vision truly cares about Wanda, they're both obviously, especially as shown in this Edinburgh fight, and then later in the film when she has to she's trying to destroy the Vision's Mind Stone to protect Thanos from getting it. You see how protective they are of one another, how much they care for one another. And that relationship, I think, just is, it, you know, with all the chaos going on, and everyone's, you know, kind of problems with their various interpersonal relationships, to see that, you know, that foundation of love appear throughout all this, you know, craziness in this film, it's a nice change of pace, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, I certainly cannot blame you. And I love that, you know, whole concept of, you know, with very dysfunctional relationships, we actually have a relationship that works, which is wonderful indeed. And what about you, John? I mean, what did you make of our Scarlet Witch and Vision in this film?
I was happy to see it when it came up. You could tell there were a couple. I mean, Vision and the Scarlet Witch was a series for a while. I know that. And just being a fan of Avengers, I mean, from the get-go, it was nice to finally see them together. And you got to figure that you've got two of the possibly strongest characters in the Marvel Universe at that point in time. They even though they're getting their butts handed to them, they still fight together as a couple, and you could tell that she cares about him so deeply, and she's fighting tooth and nail to try and defend him, and he's already damaged to the point where he's having a hard time even standing up. But yeah, the two of them, they worked so well together. I was so glad to see them as WandaVision and as we know it now. But and just the fact that I think that the fact that they're kind of hidden away in Edinburgh, that probably added to it, kind of bolstered the relationship a little bit, because the last time we saw them together, and they were just colleagues, basically just co-workers, and now they're a full-blown couple. And I love the there's a sign on one of the windows it just screams Scotland. It says we'll deep fry your kebab because everything's fried in Scotland. So they had to put that on one of the windows. I loved it. But it was relationship. By that time, it was believable. It was that's what the comic was.
Oh yes, well, very true. And you know, talking about the deep frying thing on the Blu-ray commentary, you know, folks, if you ever want to check it out, I strongly suggest that you do. This is the commentary of the Russo brothers of this film. That was actually shot in Scotland, and they said they actually do deep fry everything possible. So yep. Apparently, the Russos, while they were there, actually sampled fried Scottish cooking. So I definitely envy them that, because I'm a huge fan of that. But you know, as I said, apparently they were able to get a taste of the town, literally. when it
having came, yeah. Having been to Edinburgh, I can definitely verify this.
There you go, exactly. So you know, when it came to sort of me, you know, I, you know, we had seen some of the hints of the possible attraction or saplings of the possible relationship between the Scarlet Witch and the Vision, you know, somewhat in Civil War a little bit. And here, of course, we see it in its full form. You know, they're both on the run following the events of Civil War, and they're taking that time to get incredibly cozy. And of course, us comic book readers know this is a thing. And personally, I did buy it on screen. It's like Charles was mentioning, Elizabeth and Paul have great chemistry. And though this movie had to be constantly on the go, as there was so much story to tell, I'm glad we did get some idea of their relationship, which, of course, will be the focus for the upcoming TV show. And like John was mentioning, I love how protective Wanda is of the Vision during their fight with the Black Order, as you can just see by the excellent choreography that she's so frantic to want to get back to him after he's been wounded. And of course, the scene right at the end of the movie where she destroys or seemingly destroys the Infinity Stone before Thanos steps in, I thought kind of mirrors the promise that Gamora makes to Star-Lord, you know, about him killing her for the greater good. So it was kind of an interesting kind of mirroring there. And, you know, I think this movie is definitely about sacrifice. And I think that could probably be the key theme to this film is sacrifice. And what are you prepared to sacrifice to achieve a certain goal, be it the safety of the world, furthering your own agenda, etc. So on to our next topic and group characters. Next topic is, if I had a hammer, and I cannot sing to save my life, but when it comes to this theme, of course, we'll be looking at Thor, Groot, Rocket, and Eitri, the dwarf. So when it comes to you, Leslie, looking at this next trio, Thor, Groot, and Rocket, what did you think of seeing the God of Thunder paired with two Guardians of the Galaxy?
Well, I guess I would say this movie would be classified as a tragedy, and you have to have a tension breaker, and so Guardians just always is that. You know, it's the comic relief, and what I loved is that Thor, he was the straight man, you know, and yet he could, you know, cry and say he lost everything and still be funny. But I think that's because of the ensemble that he was surrounded with. I mean, you've got this classic teenager, you know, in Groot, and Rocket is just so quippy and just hilarious. I think Bradley Cooper is fantastic in, you know, as the voice of Rocket. So, but what I loved was I felt the pain, and I also laughed, and that's such a human emotion. We do that so much, you know, we fight away from the pain, we laugh through the tears, and so I loved the play, you know, that they were able to give that. It was just fantastic. I love that you know, Thor mentions that he speaks Groot because it was an elective, and I mean, it's just really clever. It was clever and easy. It was like a breath of fresh air, you know, and yet moves the story along with Thor especially and what had happened with Loki.
It very, very much does. This movie is constantly on the move. And what about you, Charles? What did you think of seeing Thor with Groot and Rocket?
Like Leslie said, I thought this was a great opportunity to let Thor wind down a little bit, obviously from the traumatic events of losing his brother at the beginning of the film. So to pair him with these much, you know, lighter, almost comic relief characters was a great chance to kind of get him to settle down a little bit and come off of that very traumatic moment. And I thought the introduction of Eitri was just, you know, just fantastic, because here you have this great actor from Game of Thrones, and you know, obviously known for playing, you know, dwarf characters because he's a little person, that you know, he gets the opportunity to here to be an actual giant. So I thought that was great that he got that opportunity. And although I thought it was kind of a missed opportunity in the sense from my comic book perspective, because creating Stormbreaker was this hammer that should have gone to a different character. Mm-hmm. This character, Betty Ray Bill, who's a very popular character from Walt Simonson's run on Thor. And I thought this, you know, that whole sequence would have been a great opportunity to introduce Betty Ray Bill into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But obviously you've got so many characters already. Maybe introducing another heavyweight at this point wasn't a great idea, but, so, you know, cause Betty Ray Bill gets that hammer, gets Stormbreaker. And so it would have been kind of nice to see Betty Ray Bill and Thor teaming up in the, you know, when facing Thanos, but it didn't happen. And, it's almost like, you know, they tried to kind of like pick and choose by giving Stormbreaker to Thor as a way to like, okay, well, you know, Thor needs a replacement hammer, so here you go. And that gets him back into the fight.
Well, yeah, yes, indeed. And then I guess I would have loved to have seen Betty Ray Bill myself, but I know, I guess we are dealing with a pretty crowded room in this film indeed. And what about you, John? I mean, what do you think of seeing Thor paired off with Groot and Rocket?
It was almost like a comedy trio at times. I thought the three of them worked great together. The whole thing with Rocket giving Thor the eye, he's like, "Oh, you might want to wash it first." It was like, I was cracking up. And then when we're introduced to Eitri, and he's referring to him as Eitri the dwarf, all of a sudden this huge giant comes on screen, and the whole theater lost it. It was fantastic. But he needs the hammer because he's dying. It kind of harkened a little bit back to Ragnarok, where Odin says, "Well, you're not Thor, the god of hammers," but then again, it gave him his strength. And it was kind of odd with him getting Stormbreaker like that, because like Charles said, I mean, Beta Ray Bill was always the one he had Stormbreaker, and thankfully we saw a little snippet of him in Thor Ragnarok on one of the faces on the tower. So yeah, I mean, hopefully soon we will see him in the MCU. But I love the three of them together. I loved at the end during the huge fight where all of a sudden, it's just the Bifrost comes down, and you see the three of them emerge, and here's Thor just ready to go at it with anybody, and just to get to the Thanos, and it worked. It really did. I was so happy with how the three of them worked together.
Oh, it certainly worked indeed. And what about you, Kelly? You know, you having seen, you know, once again, having discussed, you know, Thor Ragnarok and such, and seeing him now embark on this journey and meet, you know, Groot and Rocket. Well, how do you think, what were your thoughts on that?
Well, I feel like, you know, coming out of Ragnarok, I mean, we're right out of Ragnarok into Infinity War. So not only has Thor watched his home planet be destroyed, his father die, his sister try to take over, you know, Asgard. Then Thanos shows up right at the end of Ragnarok, invades the last of the surviving folks from Asgard, and he's been through the ringer. So that to run him off and let Stormbreaker be born and to you know, roll him into that situation gave him a little bit of time to hash out some of those feelings and maybe you know, get him to the point that he's ready to fight again. And it does. I mean, you get to the end of the movie and he's a walking force of nature towards the end. And I think that's the buildup to it. I think it also allows them to remove one of the most powerful Avengers to the side so that, you know, we have the chance for each of the group of Avengers, you know, to face off against Thanos in their own time. But it's just, to me, it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you get to watch it, you get to laugh, you know, you've been stunned from beginning to end in this movie. And in those little breaks, you really get to just kind of relax a little bit and you get to laugh. I think the way that they brought Stormbreaker into being, you have a living, you know, weapon, and then, you know, Groot gives it its handle. So you have a living handle. So it really puts the emphasis on, you know, this is a part of, you know, the mythology and that kind of thing. And I agree, Beta Ray, you get to see his likeness in Thor Ragnarok, but we don't get to see him in this one. I think that he's coming, though. I think we're going to see, you know, as Thor moves forward, I think as Chris Hemsworth gets tired of being Thor, I think we're going to see more of Beta Ray Bill and some other folks that have held the hammer or Stormbreaker throughout the comics. So I think that's what Marvel's building up to. And it's a good way to bring Stormbreaker into lore, you know. And, you know, I know it's Beta Ray's weapon, but, you know, at the end of the day, you can only fit so many heroes on a screen at once. And that's what I agree with everybody when, you know, you come down to it. You only got so much screen time, so much room, and introducing a new character into the midst of all that's going on in Infinity War probably would have got lost in the shuffle. So I think it was kind of wise to hold back on that one until later. But yeah, I mean, you can't go wrong with Rocket and Groot. I mean, they've been just absolutely hilarious through every movie you've got to see them in, and it's fantastic. So.
Oh, it certainly is. And, you know, as Charles and John, you know, already kind of expressed their feelings on this character, what did you make of Peter Dinklage as Eitri the Dwarf?
I loved it. I, you know, going into the movie, I didn't, you know, like I said, I kind of just kind of blanked everything out. I didn't realize that's who it was going to be until I actually got to see the movie. And it did come off as very hilarious that, you know, we have a guy that's been playing little people, you know, in all kinds of movies and on Game of Thrones. And then the next thing you know, he's the biggest guy in the room. And that wasn't lost on me. you know, it was kind of funny. And, well, it wasn't kind of funny. It was really funny, actually. And the way Peter pulls it off through this whole thing, I just felt like he did a really good job playing a big little person. And it just, it was fantastic. And, you know, the whole time you're just sitting there going, what race of dwarfs did this guy come from? He's huge. So, you know,
if he's a dwarf, what do the giants look like?
Exactly. That was my next. Yeah, that's where I was kind of going with that. What do the other people look like? So, you know, I think it's fantastic. I think it really played well. And I think, you know, we might see some more of him in the Marvel Cinematic Universe as it goes, especially if we're getting Guardians of the Galaxy and things like that. I think our space adventures are not quite over for Marvel.
Oh, definitely not by a long shot. And actually, today is Peter Dinklage's 51st birthday on the day of this recording, so it couldn't be more apropos. And Leslie, you know, what did you think of the character of Eitri? Were you a fan of Peter Dinklage before this film?
Well, I haven't seen... I've seen him in a lot of things. And so, for me, he's just a very familiar face and a very familiar voice. I mean, his voice has been in all kinds of things. And I had no idea who was going to be in there. I love the play on the giant who's, you know, I thought that was so cool for him as an actor. You know, why not, right? Why not get to be something that, you know, everybody else may get to be, or something that you've never gotten to be. So, but yeah, I thought it was cool. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, when you hear a familiar voice, see a familiar face, there's an endearing quality to it, and he certainly has that in everything that you see him in.
Oh, yes. Well, Peter Dinklage is fantastic. I actually, you know, Charles knows this, and I believe a few other of you know this. I have not, I've only watched one episode of Game of Thrones, and I stopped there because it's just not my speed. But yeah, I was privileged enough to see Peter Dinklage, not only in this film, but also as Bolivar Trask in the X-Men franchise, and he did a fantastic job in that indeed. Well, when it came to me personally, I mean, I think Thor is the character in the MCU that more than anybody has undergone the traditional hero's journey, and this is kind of his big moment and climax, as it were, or so it may seem. And we can tell we're dealing with a guy who is incredibly shell-shocked, and we will see this more so in Endgame, as though he tries to brush things off with humor. I think we can tell that everything he has gone through is taking its toll on him. And this is somewhat, I think, explored in his talk with Rocket on their way to Nidavellir, as you can see an incredibly cynical character like Rocket come to terms with a man who has witnessed the death of his family and his best friend in Heimdall, not to mention he has not even been able to check in with the woman he loves, i.e. Jane Foster, which, of course, you know, is a whole big thing, but we won't go down that rabbit hole. I feel that the exchange between the two is a great set piece of emotional acting and serves the film very well. As though it is a movie in constant motion, it does allow for important character moments. Groot, I mean, of course, he has a very light arc. I mean, it was a great idea to have him sacrifice part of himself to create the handle of Stormbreaker, as you guys have said. But he is mainly, like you were saying, Leslie, a bratty teenager engrossed in his video game and barely minding his surroundings or what was going on. And finally, with Peter Dinklage, he's a fabulous actor. And I think, you know, we get a very solemn and sad character. And I certainly hope we do get to see him again under more felicitous circumstances. So he is definitely hoping. So, guys, we did talk about another chap who, like Spider-Man, loves to drop pop culture references, who has quite an arc in this film, the one who is one sandwich away from fat, Chris Pratt, as Peter Quill, Star-Lord. So when it comes to Chris Pratt and the character of Star-Lord and what he gets up to in this movie, what did you guys think of him? Let's start with you, Charles. What did you think of Star-Lord in this film?
Hey, he's getting a Bowflex. And he's going to commit. Okay. So just lay off. No. Chris Pratt, you know, obviously as anyone who has watched the two Guardians of the Galaxy films knows, you know, just he's such a fun character playing Peter Quill, you know, this coming from the 80s and having that, you know, that 70s music soundtrack that from his mom. And so, you know, he's also kind of that tension breaker character in a lot of scenes because he's a bit of a goofball, but at the same time though, you know, he gets to play off, or, you know, have this kind of almost a tragic romance with Gamora, which ultimately we know how that turns out in this movie. You know, you see him being goofy, you know, with other heroes and one scene, but you also see that tender side of him and how much he cares for Gamora, and that comes through as well. So it helps to kind of round out his character, flesh him out a little bit, and show that he's just more than basic comic relief. And you know, he has a number of great moments. Although he does have one horrible moment where, and I'm sure everybody knows which one, when it looks like, well, hey, everybody is just about able to pull the Infinity Gauntlet off of Thanos and ending this whole threat right here and there until, well, hey, Peter kind of, well, loses it at the worst possible time. And kind of indirectly becomes responsible for half the universe's population getting wiped out of existence. Don't.
This is very, very true. And what about you, John? What did you make of our Star-Lord in this film?
I've liked him since the first Guardians. I mean, he's just like just that quirky. He's got to be the guy that everyone he wants as much attention as he can get. And even when Thor comes aboard the ship, I mean, he's just the way he's interacting with Thor. Just so it's like, okay, he almost seems like they're gonna like him better than him. So he's kind of acting a little above and trying to be better than Thor. I love the relationship with him and Gamora. He's so used to just. The Guardians are going to go in there. They're going to kick ass, take names, and then they're going to go find something else to do. But at this point in time, I mean, it's not as serious until Gamora says to him, okay, swear on your mother. And then that's when he realizes that, okay, this is serious. And it was a great moment. Of course, you get Drax coming in for the comic relief because, It was starting to become a really deep scene, so you want to liven it up a little bit. But he gets so emotionally attached that during that fight when he's hitting Thanos, as soon as he finds out that she's dead, you got to fault him for what happened, but you can't fault him for why he did it.
No, definitely very true. I mean, he is in a very tough position for sure. And what about you, Kelly? What did you make of Star-Lord in this film and what we got of him?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, Chris Pratt kind of set the bar a little high when he started with Guardians of the Galaxy. And, you know, when I first heard they picked Chris Pratt to play, you know, Star-Lord for Guardians of the Galaxy, I was nonetheless a little apprehensive. I mean, I'd seen him play in other things. I knew he had the comedy chops. But, you know, he wasn't necessarily the guy in the room with the big muscles. So, you know, seeing him come in and then, you know, seeing his jealousy when they find Thor and, you know, everything starts getting explained. I mean, it's true to form for Star-Lord. I mean, Star-Lord wants to be the center of the universe, and I think he gets that from his father. you know, we get to see a little bit of that that attitude come through with him. I mean, he is half, you know... he is half of, you know, one of the ancients. So, you know, it's one of those things where you just kind of, you're kind of caught off guard every once in a while by actually how jealous he is in the beginning of the movie of, you know, the attention Thor's getting. I mean, it is a new person arriving, you know, you pulled in from outer space and he wakes up. That doesn't happen every day. So, you know, and then, you know, to move in through the movie and, you know, the serious scene between him and Gamora again, you know, she's like, hey, you got to do this. And, you know, obviously Drax and all that, you know, breaking that up, like John said before, and then, you know, moving into, you know, when Thanos actually gets his hands on her and, you know, Thanos knew that Star-Lord would pull the trigger because that's what she asked him to do. And, you know, the bubbles, that was kind of cool. So, you know, the lasers into a bubble, that was pretty cool. And, you know, it's a cruel joke from Thanos, but it was definitely, you know, one of those relief moments when you have a very serious situation going on, you know, and then, you know, just him finding out that she's gone and his reaction to these things, it's Star-Lord through and through. He wants to be the center of attention, but he does care and he does care about everybody around him. And it really does show in this movie, even though we get the spurned schoolboy in the first part of this, I think the rest of it turns into him really understanding and coming to grips with the fact that this is a world ending event and it could change everybody. So.
Yes, indeed. I mean, and he does undergo quite an arc from, should we say, the boy who witnesses his mom dying from cancer in the first Guardians of the Galaxy film. And Leslie, you know, you and I, of course, discussed the first Guardians of the Galaxy on this podcast. You know, going from that very first film to seeing where Peter has come to, you know, through his story arc, what did you think of Star-Lord's journey coming into Infinity War at this point?
Yeah, I remember we were talking about, you know, when I heard that Chris Pratt was going to play the character, it was literally like the guy from Parks and Rec. I can't see it, you know. and I think, and especially in a comedy situation, I think flawed characters make the best characters. If you can make fun of them, they're relatable and they're endearing. And I think he's really settled more and more into that. He doesn't see himself well, you know, a lot of us don't. And that also gives a lot of fuel for the fire, you know, of other people making fun of him. And he's really, to me, he's kind of the heart of the group. And I love all the pop culture. Every time I see this movie, I remember I have to see Footloose. I've never seen it. And apparently it's the best movie of all time. So so I keep meaning to see it and I haven't done it yet. But he really is Peter Quill. I mean, there's no denying. And he's had plenty of time to really make that character what it is. And I think he does a fantastic job of it.
He very much does. I will certainly agree with you. As you know, as I said, he does go through quite an emotional journey, you know, because like Thor, he has suffered quite a lot. I mean, the guy's lost his mom as a child. He's come off also of losing both his adoptive father, Yondu, and has also had to kill his own father, Ego. So he is coming in with quite a lot of psychological baggage, you know, plus we do get that he and Gamora are an item. And I was so excited about seeing how he would behave when meeting the Avengers. And I think the payoff is fantastic, as he is very much a hothead himself. And of course, no surprise, he clashes with Tony Stark. But heck, everybody clashes with Tony Stark. The man goes through quite a journey here, and I think ends up, of course, losing the woman he loves in Gamora, whom we will be getting to shortly. I think he works so well with the other Avengers, and I could see him striking up a friendship in the long run with Spider-Man, as you could see them geeking out over pop culture. And now, he could also be considered the reason why the plan on Titan in relieving Thanos from the Infinity Gauntlet fails, and I will agree with you guys on that, but I guess at the same time, his reaction is more than understandable. But yeah, I guess a lot of people is like, this is on you, Star-Lord. The reason why we're where we're at is because of you. But all in all, I definitely love this character indeed. So
he had one job. One job.
Exactly. Peter Quill, you had one job and you failed miserably, but that's how it goes. But as we did mention her, let's get to the woman whom, at least in this film, is the one whom many say makes the greatest sacrifice of all the characters, Zoe Saldana as Gamora. So starting with you, John, what did you think of, you know, Gamora's arc and what we got to see her do in this film?
She's been one of my favorite characters since we were introduced to her. I mean, she's the thing that's with the MCU that's they write these characters for the movies a lot differently for the comics because they want to sell tickets. The comic version is a little bit different, but at the end of the day, I mean, it's still a great character. And her arc that from the first Guardians movie all the way up until this one, I mean, at one point in time, when you realize that she knows where that Soul Stone is and she knows what the sacrifice is going to be, it's heart wrenching because you know that once they go there, she ain't coming back, and she realizes that herself too. But all in all, you've got the relationship between her and Peter. You've got the relationship between her and her adopted sister, and they all work well together. I mean, Nebula is like way different than she is in the comics, but and the way they've written these movies, I mean, they just play off each other so well. And the character of Gamora, she's been such a strong female lead.
She very much has, and we definitely will get more, of course, of Gamora and Nebula in Endgame, but of course we are talking Infinity War here. When it comes to you, Kelly, what did you think of Gamora's journey in this film?
Well, I think every character that Marvel's written, and Marvel Comics is famous for this, I think everybody has that backstory where they're broken. I mean, having a father like Thanos, really, I mean, how can you not be a little broken? And her affinity for, you know, Quill, and all that stuff, you know, you break it into many different parts and pieces, but it took her a while to even warm up to Star-Lord. And that's the whole point of this, is that, you know, he basically took his time, whereas before he's always been a fly by the seat of his pants kind of guy, and you get to see that relationship between those two blossom over the course of several movies. And, you know, it's one of those things that you know that there's that relationship there, and you know that they'd do anything for each other. And I think that, you know, her role in this, she knew when Thanos came what her role in this was going to wind up being. And I think, you know, we'll move, you know, it'll move on past this, you know, in other movies, but, you know, her death was one of the big ones in this movie, because, you know, what's the one thing that Thanos cherishes more than anything else? And a lot of people are standing there going, there's no way he's getting the Infinity Stone, because he doesn't care about anything other than, you know, other than his mission and himself and those kind of things. But true to form, you know, we got to see a little part of Thanos that maybe through her, you know, we got to see that he does care about things and people in general. Because in his own twisted way, he's trying to right a lot of wrongs in the universe, so to speak, or at least in his mind he is. And I think Gamora really is the antithesis of that when it comes to, she's the other side of that coin. She's the one thing that, you know, there's two, you know, major players in this whole game that care more for her than anything else. And it turns out to be Star-Lord and Thanos. And, you know, that says a lot about her character and about who she is. And I think the way it's been played and written, and she nails it every time. And John was right. It's not the Gamora from the comic books, and it's not the, you know, it's not some of the, you know, we don't get the comic book a lot, you know, but they roll on these stories, and they have to make them, you know, believable to us, and they can't be as outlandish as they were in the comics, like we expect them to be. But her character in this is just more than believable, and the value that her life contained, I don't think anybody really realized how much her relationships were worth until this movie.
Very well said. And I suppose we couldn't really have a kind of true to form for comics, because if she was that way, it would probably be an R-rated movie, seeing as in the comics, she pretty much runs around wearing basically nothing.
Exactly.
But Leslie, you know, when it comes to you, you know, you and I did discuss Gamora on our review of Guardians of the Galaxy. What do you think of, you know, seeing the Gamora we got to see in the first Guardians of the Galaxy to here? What did you think of the journey this character has undergone?
Yeah, there's a very evident and deep character arc that goes on, and you know, if you even just look at Gamora and Peter, and the fact that neither one of them has been parented, they both suffered such a tragic loss as kids. They kind of go about surviving differently, and I think Peter is the one who teaches her to trust and to love and to open up her heart, and then in turn, she passes that to Nebula, because she now, her eyes have been opened. She realizes what Nebula has suffered through. And that then, of course, leads to, in this movie, her deeply wanting to spare Nebula's pain and life, and being willing to do whatever it takes, you know, to do that. It's really strong. It's really deep. And I think because it's so deep, and it's like going from, you know, the Guardians, we said, is like that nice comic relief. And then you've got the story with Gamora and Thanos and that relationship and what she has to do is it's so real. And it's such a tragic story, tragic character, that you really need the balance in the film. And because this gets real. I think also just backing up to Peter and his big mistake that he makes, I was just thinking, you know, if he hadn't made that big mistake, I think the movie would have been over. So I guess I was really mad. I actually thought maybe it was a flaw for a minute there. And then my next thought was, well, somebody had to mess up, because, you know, if they had gone through with it, the movie would be over and we'd all be going home. So I was really glad he made his big tragic mistake.
Oh, well, no, of course. I mean, because then, of course, we've got the great pathos that we got later on. And when it comes to you, Charles, you know, what did you think of Gamora in this film and the sacrifice that she makes?
Well, one of the things that was completely unexpected when I saw this movie in the theaters, that in a pleasant way, was that we actually kind of get the origin of Gamora in this movie. We see her as a young child. Thanos shows up on her planet, lays waste to their planet and her planet, and he takes her in. And you see how tender he was with her. Even, you know, like there's kind of like an execution squad ready to kill a bunch of people of her, you know, her fellow citizens of her planet. And he kind of turns her head away, distracts her with that little double-edged knife, and tries to protect her from that. Although she can hear the screams, he's still trying to save her some of that. So ultimately he takes her in, as we find out. And so because of that, he feels protective of her, although, you know, obviously their relationship is extremely complicated, as is Thanos's relationship with Nebula. And so that now later as an adult, when they go to that planet, Voris, and Thanos needs to make a sacrifice in order to get the Soul Stone, and on Vormir, I'm sorry, and you know that Gamora kind of calls him out, and she goes, well, you know, ha ha ha, you obviously can't give up what you love because you love nothing. And Thanos kind of looks at her, and in this really awkward moment for Gamora, you know, she obviously comes to realize, well, yeah, he does love something. He actually cares for her far more than she thought possible. And as a result, he makes the decision to sacrifice her to get that Soul Stone. And it's a huge moment in the film. And you see the lengths that Thanos is willing to go to achieve his goal.
Oh, yes, very much. I mean, it is all about, I suppose, sacrifices, I was mentioning before, you know, because I think, you know, she's almost the mirror image, like I was saying, of Wanda when it comes to sacrifice. Because like you were saying, Charles, she has an incredibly complicated relationship with her adopted father, whom, like some abusive relationships, I think she does have some love for her abuser. I mean, she's ready to put her life on the line for the greater good when she asks Quill to promise her that he will kill her when push comes to shove. But I was rather shocked at her sacrifice, and I thought to myself, if they stick with this decision, they are seriously showing great chutzpah, to use a Yiddish term. I mean, I don't think she really wants to kill Thanos at first, but is prepared to do it, because I think there is some love there. But she has to do everything in her power to stop him for the greater good. And I did find their exchanges incredibly moving, and it seems like Thanos is constantly, but slowly but surely, creeping into our conversation here, and we will get to him, I promise. But before we get to Daddy Dearest, let's look at his minions, the Black Order, or the Children of Thanos, where we have, of course, Ebony Maw, played by Tom Vaughan Lawler, Black Dwarf in the comics, which was renamed Cole Obsidian in this film, played by Terry Notary, Proxima Midnight, played by Carrie Coon, and Corvus Glaive, played by Michael James Shaw. Now, when it came to the Black Order, or in this case, the Children of Thanos, Kelly, what did you think of this this group of Thanos' minions?
Incompetent?
Yeah.
No, come on. I don't think Thanos was necessarily banking on encountering, you know, as many of the Avengers as he did. But I mean, the thing about this movie is, you know, over and over again, these guys, they come, they try to get an Infinity Stone, they're doing this, they're doing that, and every time you turn around, they're being thwarted by somebody, whether it's Wanda and Vision and Captain America and Black Widow, or, you know, it's Spider-Man and Tony Stark and Iron Man and Doctor Strange. it just, it's one thing after the other for these guys, and they're just not having any luck in this movie, which, you know, it's kind of par for the course. I mean, they're the underlings, they're the lackeys, you know, it's kind of like if you want something done, you got to do it yourself kind of situation, which Thanos undertakes in this movie, obviously. But the point is, these guys, it gave movement to the movie. In the comics, I think sometimes they're a little more competent than they were in this film when it comes down to certain things that they have to accomplish. But I you know, you see these things and they're just big bad guys, and it's nice to just see the Avengers get to, you know, fight on par with someone that, you know, is at their level and not necessarily overpowered and ready to crush everything under the sun. So they're just riding the coattails of Thanos, and it's obvious in this film. And I do believe there's some things in the there's a few times in the comics that they have their time in the sun, but for the most part, you know, throughout these films, they're kind of they antagonize through the whole film, and then it culminates into the final battle. And obviously, you know, they're leading the hordes, and it's payback time for some of the Avengers. I mean, they're none too kind to them in the end of this movie, but it really brings it kind of to full circle that, you know, the bad guys aren't necessarily all that organized sometimes. It's half a dozen, one sixth of the other. They're there for a purpose, and they move things forward. Obviously they didn't have huge roles in this, you know, huge, huge, huge roles in this movie, but they did do what they were intended to do, and that was move things along. And I think that's how we move the story along. You got to have threat, and you got to have somebody, you know, in the background, always, you know, kind of waiting in the wings. And that's kind of Marvel's ticket to all this is, you know, we got to be able to work this up and build it. And I think these guys built everything until this final battle in Wakanda. So, you know, it was fantastic. I loved them. I found it humorous a lot of times when they were battling and doing different things. So it was good though. I did enjoy it.
Oh, well, they definitely were a great menace indeed. What did you think, Leslie, of the Children of Thanos?
Well, the one that really stood out to me the most, I think, is Ebony Maw. And I think it's because there was sort of a cult-like thing about the Black Order, you know, and he specifically just loved the psychological torture, you know, and sometimes it was kind of dark and creepy, and sometimes it was hilarious when it didn't really work out for him. And again, I liked that because it added that mysterious creepiness, but it also was something to play off of when, you know, he did his best, you know, especially with like Doctor Strange, and things just didn't quite work out for him. For the most part, you know, he was the one I think that probably was the strongest, at least in this movie. And I don't know, you know, the background so well, but, I did like the girl fight in Wakanda, which we'll probably get to later, but yeah, I thought it was an interesting, relationship, you know, to call Thanos father and that they were basically like the children of that to me was a very cult like setup, which made it interesting.
Oh, it was very interesting indeed. I mean, I thought it was a great concept for this movie. And Charles, you know, I'm sure, you know, you have encountered the Black Order in your comic book readings. What do you think of, you know, compared from comics to screen, you know, from the Black Order to the Children of Thanos, what did you think of our group of minions?
Yeah, I was, like you said, I was familiar with the Black Order as a fan of Jonathan Hickman's Infinity miniseries for Marvel. So it was really surprising when I learned of their addition to this movie, because they were created so recently, and to see them like already on the big screen was a nice surprise. It made sense here because, well, Thanos needs some henchmen, and that's basically their role here. Like Leslie said, the only one that really seems to have anything going on within the group is Ebony Maw, with those very formidable telekinetic abilities. And you know, he's a character that, you know, just as essentially what he is, he's Thanos' herald here, and trying to almost kind of like Legacy said, in this cult-like manner, trying to preach the word of Thanos, so to speak. And he goes out, but he has this sadistic quality to him that, you know, he's a guy who really enjoys his work, especially when that rather really uncomfortable interrogation scene where he has Doctor Strange at the mercy of these, you know, like metallic needles surrounding him and cutting into his cheek and you know, just making you squirm as you watch this, you know, at least Ebony Maw in particular was at least a formidable threat, even when Thanos wasn't around.
Oh, they were definitely formidable indeed. And what about you, John? What did you think of the Children of Thanos?
I was surprised that they were in the movie because, like Charles said, they're more recent in the Infinity Gauntlet, and then following that, the Infinity War, they weren't even in there. So when I saw that they were coming on screen, I was just like, okay, this is interesting. But I think they were I believe they were more filler, because when you have a character like Thanos that very few can go toe to toe and defeat him, you need something for your heroes to beat in a battle, and they did that. The one lost his hand through one of Doctor Strange's portals, and someone in the audience was just like, why couldn't they done that to Thanos with the Infinity Gauntlet? I was like, yeah, I can see what you're saying there. But and they were very strong characters, though. There was a thing online that I read that the sash of I can't think of the big guy's name with the axe off the top of my head. The sash that he wears has it's the colors of Captain Marvel. So there was supposed to be some sort of backstory between the two of them, which we never saw.
Also, between Co-Obsidian and Captain Marvel.
Co-Obsidian, yes. I'm sorry. Yes, if you look at the sash that he wears, it's her colors that she wears at the end of Captain Marvel when she gets the blue and blue, red, and gold. So there's something that should have happened, but they never worked with it. But I enjoyed them. They're fun to watch.
Who knows? Maybe we might see, you know, if and when we get the Captain Marvel sequel, we might see Co-Obsidian with Captain Marvel. Who knows? But probably, you know, as most of you, you know, were saying, I you know, my favorite, of course, was Ebony Maw. And I love that there is a bit of a callback, you know, for you comic book fans out there to Mephisto, who plays a sizable role in the Infinity War storyline comic book wise. You do wonder whether with his power set, he may have been able to take on Thanos. I mean, if he so wished. But we do get the idea, like Charles was saying, of the Herald, and shall we say maybe head of the Thanos fan club. You know, as he never wastes a moment to say how amazing Thanos is and evidently embraces his vision of rebalancing the universe. Co-Obsidian, I think, was a cool appetizer to have at the start of the movie and an entertaining villain. And I also did like that we got somewhat of a hint that Proxima Midnight and Corvus Glaive are a couple, as you get this more in the comics, but they gave it, I mean, I suppose those who don't know, you might not really have gotten it, but yes, they are a couple, and because you can see she is a little bit protective of him, and they often pair off, so I did like that as well, and I totally get why we weren't given much more of a backstory when it came to these characters, as we had so much going on. But I do strongly suggest to our listeners to read up on these characters, as they have a fascinating backstory. So let's get to our big bad, whom may not necessarily see himself as the big bad, Josh Brolin as Thanos, whom we'd also seen, of course, as Cable in Deadpool 2. And of course, you know, we'll also look at his 50% plan of rebalancing the universe. So, Leslie, when it comes to you, what did you think of Thanos as our villain, quote unquote?
Well, you know, earlier I think I was saying that one of the things about the bad guy is that you love to love him, you know, and he's endearing, and that was Loki. And I think the other thing about a really good bad guy is that they believe truly that they're good guys. And, you know, Thanos believes with all his heart, if he has one, that this is the right answer, that this is the mathematical equation that will solve the problem. And so he thinks that he's doing a good thing. He thinks he's the only one doing a good thing. And it was very believable to me. He's a lonely guy. He's interesting. I think his levels are interesting because you see the lonely, you see the, at least he thinks he loves Gamora. As far as he knows what love is, he thinks he loves Gamora, has some kind of feelings for her that seem like love. And yet the flip side is he's okay with being cruel, with torturing. He's very militaristic in many ways. Seems like a sociopath, as I said before. And I love what Charles said, that he, you know, he would preach the word of Thanos. And the whole thing is very cult-like and disturbing, very disturbing. So I personally think Josh Brolin's fantastic, and his voice is very recognizable and likable in a weird way. You know, if he was kind of overacting the villain, I think it would have been hokey, but he lays it back and just kind of has that almost endearing voice, you know, Josh Brolin. So for me, it worked. It worked well.
That's great to hear. And when it comes to you, Charles, what did you think of Thanos and, you know, compared to, say, the comics and what we got here?
Yeah. Excuse me. I love Josh Brolin's Thanos. He brings this, like Leslie said, this understatedness to the role that, you know, he brings a lot of depth to what is essentially a CGI character, and gives such weight to every line that he delivers. So every line that he delivers, it matters here, and you can't help but be fascinated by this villain that, he's not out to, like, control the universe. He's not out to, you know, like, rob banks or whatever typical superhero storylines here. His goal is essentially like, well, hey, you have the universe and it's completely overpopulated. So in order for the universe to thrive, we kind of need to cull things back. And I figure, well, hey, we'll just take, 50% off the population, and that should do it, right? So he goes through this orchestrated plan, and which obviously takes the course of dozens of Marvel films to finally come to fruition here, and he follows through on it. It's not so, and what I love most about this movie, As a standalone film, is that in this movie, the bad guy wins. And, Marvel Cinematic Universe movies in particular have been long accused of being formulaic. They're almost paint by numbers in terms of plot. But this movie completely throws that out the window, because you have the bad guy winning. In this movie, he succeeds. He follows through on his goal. 50% of the universe is wiped out, and even with the sacrifice, you know, he sacrificed Gamora. He fought off all these heroes trying to stop him, and you know, he triumphed. And how it's very rare that in any kind of movie involving heroes and villains where you see the villain actually win, and it gives Avengers Infinity War, it almost makes it feel like this is the Empire Strikes Back of the Marvel Cinematic Universe as a result. Mm-hmm. It's that film that completely blows your expectations away, and it feels like that, you know, that it's a game changer, and it was completely unexpected. And even though, you know, eventually the heroes are going to triumph in the next film, for right now, Thanos wins. And because of that, it's probably why it's one of my top 10 films.
Very much so. I mean, because I think the only movie that possibly accomplishes this, but you know, like only halfway, you know, which is a completely different movie, this is Megamind, where you actually get the villain win. So it's a very good point there for sure, Charles. And when it comes to you, John, you know, what did you think of Thanos?
Well, and like Charles said, I mean, this is this was basically a Thanos movie, completely different from the Infinity Gauntlet comic. I mean, thankfully, he didn't snap his fingers in the beginning like he did in the comic. It took took a nice story to get to it, but I mean, he had a plan from the beginning. I mean, he tells Gamora that I saw it on Titan. He said there, it got so bad to where they exhausted all the natural resources. So he knows that if he can snap his fingers after he gets all the stones, wipe out half the population, okay, guess what? Here's what's happening on your world. All the children have full bellies. They can go to sleep without any having to worry about anything else anymore. And it's they're at peace now. So what he's doing in his mind is right. He almost comes across as one of these like fanatical religious leaders, but in his mind, the ends justify the means. And this is one of those characters where, traditionally in Marvel movies, the villains have not really been the strongest. I mean, something always happens; they always get defeated. Well, in this one, like Charles said, the goodies don't win. And at the end of the day, he does what he set out to do. And he said, you know what? I'm just going to sit there and look on everything and smile. And that's what he does at the end of the movie.
This is very true. And what about you, Kelly? You know, you, I suppose, also being familiar with the Thanos version in the comics, what did you think of, this, should we say, Thanos driven movie?
Well, the word cult has come up a lot, you know, from everybody, and I understand that mentality when you're looking at this film. And I think part of what drives that mentality, especially when it comes to Thanos, is it's almost not an arrogance, and it's not necessarily all ego. I think it's his actual belief in them, what he's doing is the right thing for the universe. And I think that air of confidence that Josh Brolin portrayed in this, just the calmness that he's always speaking in, and he's resolute in his mission to right what he sees as the universe being wrong. And that doesn't necessarily always make him a bad guy. I mean, we do that in our normal lives every day. You know, when we see something, you know, you can talk from everything from, you know, not to bring anything into it, but like global warming to whatever's going on in the world today, to the pandemic, all that kind of stuff. He is single-handedly marching forward in his mind with this mission that will right all the things that are off balance in the universe. And whether that's heroes or regular human beings, 50% of the population is going to go away across the universe. And, you know, he feels like that will even the scale. And what he, I think what Thanos doesn't understand in this movie, and what comes across ultimately, you know, coming towards the end of this thing, is that, you know, he doesn't understand that human nature, or the nature of any other alien life, you know, in the Marvel universe, is not to just sit back and take these things and we're going to, you know, repopulate the earth. We're going to repopulate, you know, these species are going to go on and we're going to be right back in the same spot we were, you know, 100 years from when he snapped his fingers. You know, we could be right back where we started. And I don't think that, you know, I don't think Thanos is seeing the long part of that. And I think that's where his ego and everything comes into this. And I think that Josh Brolin did a really good job of the very short-sightedness of what Thanos is thinking this whole movie, and really pinpointing all of the things that, you know, he sits back and says, I've made all these sacrifices and blah, 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 how committed he is to, you know, his goal in this movie. And it's just amazing to watch. And the fact that the character is CGI and you forget that he's CGI because so much life was breathed into this character with all the teasers running up to this movie, him coming into this movie with a bang, so to speak, that kind of thing. It really, I mean, it all paid off for Marvel in this movie. And again, you know, the bad guy won. But you're also talking about a guy that in the comics dares to court Lady Death, you know. So this guy has an ego and he does have a lot of things, but his belief in his ability and his mission far outweigh, I think, his ego and his eccentricism in this particular situation. So, yeah, I think that's where we get this fanaticism from, you know, from his followers and him himself. I think he's fanatical about this. I don't think it's just something that, you know, he's been stewing on this for, well, centuries, to be quite honest. But, you know, it's one of those things. And we get it right here in this movie, and it's a pretty amazing thing to watch.
Oh, it is. It is very much an amazing thing to watch. And I think, you know, for the scope of this movie, we did need an equally big villain, and one which, of course, we had been leading up to throughout the Infinity Saga. And I think totally, you know, Thanos does not disappoint, and he lives up to his title of the Mad Titan. As you know, I very much got a, you know, he's kind of almost styling himself as a messianic figure, you know, kind of a man on a mission, if you will, as rather, you know, like Charles was saying, rather than petty world or even universe domination, he actually sets on this incredibly daunting task to restore balance to the universe. And it is actually a problem, you know, as all of us know, that has been addressed in the real world, as the population is constantly growing and the resources may not be enough. So it does touch on a very real issue. Granted, naturally, I don't espouse Thanos' practical yet incredibly insane plan on randomly wiping out 50% of a planet's population. And we notice that with the exception of Loki, he doesn't ever go out to kill people in his eyes. Only those who maybe stand in the way of his plan, as you get the impression he almost doesn't want to fight. You know, because you see, like, from the very beginning, he's wearing the armor and he divests himself of his armor almost like a prophet, and he goes on his messiah quest. I almost got a Bane kind of feel from The Dark Knight Rises, because he kind of sees himself as a freedom fighter and believes his cause is just. So I kind of got that a little bit. And, you know, going back to the relationship with Gamora, I believe he does love her and is genuinely heartbroken when he does sacrifice her. And I think to carry on this almost messianic image we get, just like God, after creating the world, he also rests on his own Sabbath. So I think it's interesting how much almost it's almost biblical in a dark way when it comes to Thanos. So definitely a fantastic, fantastic character with a great arc. So guys, at this point, anything else you wanted to bring up about this movie before we move forward?
Well, I'm just glad that they didn't bring in the Thanos copter that we saw early on in one of the Spider-Man issues.
Well, very well said. Anybody else wanted to add anything about this film?
I just think that the undertaking that they did with this film was amazing, with as many people and as many things as they had to coordinate. And how well it came to the screen was, I mean, it kind of blew away everything that came before it. And it's an epic thing that I don't think this movie will ever go away. I think it's a pretty epic movement into the world of cinematics. And I think it'll go down as probably one of the best movies to hit the screen in a long time.
Mm. Yeah, well, the fact that, you've got so many characters in this movie, and you just, when you think that, okay, this scene might be getting a little too long, they go to the next group. So it never really gets, like, you never get bored watching it.
This is very true. It is constantly in motion. Very, very well said, John. Well then, guys, at this point, I guess we can get to ratings then. Where does this movie rate for you on a scale of 1 to 10? Let's start with you, Charles. Where does this movie rate for you?
I've already talked about how much this is in my top 10, so no surprise here. I'm giving it a 10 out of 10. I'm going to go 10 out of 10 Eye of Agamotto's.
Very nice. What about you, John?
easily 10 out of 10. I want to say Iron Man suits.
Perfect. And Kelly, what about you?
I'm with these guys. I give it a 10 out of 10. I'm going to go with the Iron Spideys.
Nice.
Nice. Very nice indeed. And finally, you, Leslie, where does this movie rate for you?
Yeah, me too. 10 out of 10. I have no idea what they are, but they're 10 out of 10 somethings.
Well, I guess it's a clean sweep, as I'm also going to give this a 10 out of 10. It definitely represents the climax of our journey through the MCU as a whole. And I'm sure like I got from you, you know, your views and insights is I felt incredibly rewarded for having watched every single film before this one. So it must definitely not have been an easy job to make a balanced film with so many characters. But I think the Russos achieved this and then some. So when it comes to our, you know, comic book readers here, and did you guys have any reading recommendations for our listeners when it comes to Infinity War and maybe, you know, want to find out more about Infinity War in the comics?
I've got a couple.
Go ahead, Charles.
All right. I'm going to go with the obvious ones. So obviously I recommend the original Infinity Gauntlet miniseries from 1991, written by Jim Starlin, art by the great George Perez and Ron Lim. And this was six issues that ran and is essentially the core foundation for this movie in particular. Where you have Thanos having achieved his and having obtained the Infinity Gauntlet, faces off against heroes, and it does in fact do that epic snap that wipes out half the universe's population, and then Endgame, the next film, obviously borrows from this series as well. So. But obviously the story's told differently. So if if you're not looking to have the story repeated for you, I still recommend checking it out because you know it's told a lot differently, and you're going to be able to come at it from a much fresher perspective. And then secondly, I'd also recommend the Infinity miniseries from 2013. That was six issues by Jonathan Hickman, Jim Cheung, and Jerome Opeña. And this is what introduced the Black Order. So if you're wanting to learn a little bit more about those villains and see how effective they can be, I definitely recommend checking out the series. It's a rather complex series, but if you're the type to appreciate like Christopher Nolan movies, you will definitely appreciate Jonathan Hickman's writing. I think it's well worth the effort that you put in, and it's a pretty epic storyline. Also involving Thanos. That's my recommendations.
Some great choices indeed. And what about you, John? Did you have any reading recommendations for our listeners?
I have to echo Charles on the Infinity Gauntlet. It's not that hard to find. For if you want the individual issues, but you can also get it the trade paperback. I actually got that for my son for his birthday last year, so you got that. And then from 1973, a little harder to find, but they do have some collector's editions of it. Invincible Iron Man number 55, where it introduces Thanos. So it's thankfully I'm a proud owner of that one. But yeah, it takes you to Saturn. You're introduced to both him and Drax in the same issue.
Very nice. And what about you, Kelly? Did you have any recommendations?
Well, I think if you want to get to know Thanos a little better, I think Thanos Quest, book 1 and 2, from 1990. Jim Starlin wrote it. He was the creator of Thanos in the comic books. And it's kind of a prelude to the Infinity Gauntlet comic book series. And, you know, you get, it gives you an explanation of who Thanos is and what he wants. And I think that one really could set you up really good to run into the Infinity Gauntlet, like Charles and John said. And then one of the other ones, I think Thanos, the 2016 version, numbers 13 through 18. I think that one kind of lets you follow about what everything has happened that's happened in the Infinity War, but it leads you on to nothing happened as Thanos had planned it or anybody else imagined it. And I think it's a good it's a good read because it kind of throws everything up into some chaos and a little bit of some of the tinfoil hat theories and things that all of us comic book readers get from time to time when it comes to who's next and what's going on. And it also introduces Cosmic Ghost Rider, which is really cool. So
yes.
So if you guys get a chance to read that one, I think I would recommend that highly. Just a really good read, and it really tips off, you know, Thanos made a mistake, and so, you know, it's kind of cool.
Well, very well said, and I'm going to pair those with Thanos Rising issues 1-5 from 2013 by Jason Aaron and Simone Bianchi. For those wondering just how one ends up being determined to create cosmic genocide on a scale literally unfathomable, even in Thanos' eyes, he's doing it for the right reasons, and here's your answer. The story of how a small child ended up growing up into one of the most terrifying destructive forces in the entire universe. That's Thanos Rising 1-5 from 2013. And also I would add Marvel The End from 2003, also written by Jim Starlin. In this case, when the immortal Egyptian pharaoh Akhenaten gains cosmic powers, his first act is to annihilate the Avengers and the X-Men. The universe is endangered, and Thanos and Doctor Doom may be the world's best chance at survival. Here we get featuring lead roles for Thor, even Zeus, Captain Marvel, Doctor Strange, Namor, and the Silver Surfer. And Thanos is more powerful than you've ever seen him. So definitely check out Marvel The End from 2003 as well. So guys, we selflessly promoted stories. Let's get to shameless self-promotion. When it comes to you and what you do, where can our fine listeners find you on the interwebs? Let's start with you, Leslie.
Oh, because I don't read comic books? Hey, but I do want to give a quick, plug for Disney Plus, because I'm excited to watch the Loki and the WandaVision show. And I did hear a rumor maybe that there was a Falcon and Winter Soldier show coming too. So I'm hoping, and I'm looking forward to those. It's 2020, and I've been in the music business for 20 years, and I have a monumental birthday coming up on June 20th, 2020. So I took it upon myself to shift my career a bit, got my albums out, and now I'm working in artist development with Lion Eyes Records, working on catalog music and publishing and developing young artists. And so that's been my big news and my big move, and that would be lionizerecords.com. And just really excited about making the shift over there and bringing up some of these younger artists and kind of taking them by their hand. So that's what I'm doing.
That's fantastic. And, you know, from one, you know, artist to another, Kelly, tell us a little bit about where folks can find you on the interwebs and what you do.
So they can find me and my band Something Like Yesterday on Reverb Nation, obviously. You can watch the Veterans Forum on Facebook every Saturday. We do a live, most every Saturday. Sometimes we have things come up, but you know, you can find me, you know, professional pages, you know, on Facebook, things like that. Just all you got to do is type in my name. I'm usually the first person that comes up because I've got my fingers everywhere right now. So just trying to, you know, make the world a better place and then get some music out there in the process. So.
Well, that's wonderful indeed. And when it comes to you, Charles, you know, you're definitely a man about the interwebs. Where can folks find you and tell us a little bit about what you do on, you know, on the internet?
Oh, you flatterer, sir. if you would like to check out my stuff, please like and follow me on Twitter at Charles Skaggs, or on Instagram at Charles Skaggs, or my blog of geeky things, Damn Good Coffee and Hot, where I talk about all kinds of comic book sci-fi news, and then news of my podcast for the Southgate Media Group, including Next Up Everywhere, the Doctor Who podcast they do with Jesse, which Nick has been on once or twice, and so has John. And the Phantom Zone podcast they also do with Jesse Jackson, where we talk comic book TV shows. Right now we're talking Stargirl from the DC Universe and the CW. And then the Titan Talk, the Titans podcast, where we talk Titans and Doom Patrol from DC Universe. So we're going to be starting up talking Doom Patrol Season 2 here at the end of June. So hope everybody checks that out, as we'll be reviewing episodes week by week. And then Ghostwood, the Twin Peaks podcast, to do with Zan Sprouse, whom you've heard here on this very podcast, and also on Next Stop Everywhere, where we talk David Lynch films, we talk Twin Peaks, and if you like those pop culture references, we have a ton of them on Ghostwood. So as Zan and I are both aficionados of that, and hope everybody checks those out, and appreciate anybody that wants to listen to our podcast, and thank everybody who do currently for your support.
I definitely invite folks to check out everything that Charles does, because he, Jesse, and of course also with Zan, they always do wonderful, wonderful things. And finally, John, when it comes to you, where can folks find you on the interwebs?
Well, I first off, Leslie, happy early birthday to you.
Well, thank you.
Kelly, since we found out recently that you are also a Doctor Who fan, Charles, you got to get Kelly on as a special guest companion on Next Up Everywhere. Myself, you can find me on Facebook at John Takis, Massillon, Ohio. I also run the Ohio Type 40. It's one of the four largest Doctor Who groups in the state of Ohio. We love our Buckeye State here. And also have a little support group called Type 2 Doctor Who. It's for Doctor Who fans who are also Type 2 diabetics, just like me. We're starting to gain a little bit of traction now, which is really nice. It's just a nice little support group for fans of the show that have the same affliction. So, but yeah, we're doing some really good stuff. So,
well, and definitely congratulations for what you do indeed, John. And of course, you know, folks, if you would like to join us here on the show to discuss a movie of your choice, feel free to shoot us an email at happinessanddarknesshow@gmail.com. We also really appreciate your thoughts and feedback about the show. You can reach out to us with those also at happinessanddarknesshow@gmail.com, and we'll read them out here on the show. Feel free to show your support by giving us a like on Facebook, where you'll find us as Happiness and Darkness. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we're at HiDarknessPod, or on Instagram under HinDarkness. Also, if you'd like to support the podcast and feeling generous, you can hit the donate button on SoundCloud.com/whiskeyandcigarettes, or become patrons of ours on Patreon. That's patreon.com/happinessanddarkness. We really appreciate that. Any donators will be able to pick the movie we next discuss, even pick one of the current co-hosts we discuss it with, or come on the show themselves to discuss the movie of their choice. And speaking of things to come, next week we'll be joined by James Robert Webb to discuss the 95 Joel Schumacher film, Batman Forever. That said, when it comes to you guys, once again, I look forward to having you back here on Happiness and Darkness, and I cannot thank you enough for joining me today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nick.
Yeah, really fun.
It's always fun talking to you guys.
Oh, well, the pleasure was certainly mine. Well, folks, thanks as always for listening to the show and supporting us. We will see you next week with James Robert Webb and Batman Forever. Until then, stay super. Ciao, my people.